history through the eyes of those who lived it. This is Hometown Heroes, proudly honoring the men and women whose service and sacrifice have secured our freedom. Now, the host of Hometown Heroes, Paul Leffler.
Welcome to another edition of Hometown Heroes, the program that reminds you no matter where you live in this great country of ours, no matter how big or how small your hometown might be, there are stories all around you just waiting to be told, and we have the privilege of hearing some of those stories here each time. The idea is to honor our veterans for their service and sacrifice, to preserve their stories so we never forget the price that's been paid for our freedom. And as we take that journey, we learn so much. We're educated, we're entertained, so often we are inspired by these stories from our greatest generation. Over the years, we've been privileged to hear from quite a few Pearl Harbor survivors, people who were there on the island of Oahu on December 7th, 1941, who saw that surprise attack unfold from so many different perspectives on that fateful Sunday morning. Nobody knows for sure, but it's estimated that nationwide, a little more than 1,000 Pearl Harbor survivors remain alive today. And occasionally, we hear about them on the news. Just this week, all the local TV stations were out in Tulsa, Oklahoma to celebrate Lonnie Cook, one of the last five men alive who was on the USS Arizona during that attack. He just moved to the Sacramento area, and the people of Tulsa gave Lonnie and his wife Marietta a special send-off with the help of a nonprofit called A Soldier's Wish. Another one of those Arizona survivors, Don Stratton, who you've heard from on this program, was honored last month in Colorado Springs, where a bridge on Interstate 25 was named in his honor. Colorado Springs is still mourning the death of Jim Downing earlier this year at the age of 104. Jim's book, The Other Side of Infamy, is one of the most uplifting Pearl Harbor books I've read. But the focus of today's program is going to be another man who just completed his journey here on Earth. Of all the Pearl Harbor survivors I've been privileged to spend a little time with, there's nobody I was blessed to form a deeper connection with than Chuck Lishman and his wonderful wife, Dorothy. Theirs was the only 75th wedding anniversary party I've ever been invited to, and they marked their 77th anniversary just 9 days before his passing, July 6th, at the age of 97. Last weekend, I was in Coarse Gold, California, to celebrate his remarkable life, remembered so fondly by 4 children, 10 grandchildren, 25 great-grandchildren, and so many friends whose lives he touched. As I drove away from that rural church last weekend, I thought, I need to share some of Chuck's story with our Hometown Heroes audience. So that's what we're going to do today. I met the Lishmans over a decade ago through their involvement with a local Pearl Harbor Survivors chapter. Sadly, almost every chapter like that in the country has disbanded now, San Diego being the lone exception I know of. Our friend Stu Headley there keeps it hopping with more than a dozen survivors still on their rolls. When we started this Hometown Heroes radio program in 2007, it aired live from a local radio studio each week in tandem with the series I was producing on television. And the memories you'll hear from today come from those radio and TV interviews back in 2007. In all the years since, I've watched the Lishmans do everything they can to honor the legacy of Pearl Harbor, from pulling a large-scale model of the USS Arizona Memorial in multiple parades annually, to ringing the bell each year on December 7th in honor of the fallen, to putting up with my crazy questions at different speaking engagements that we would go to together. The Lishmans are the kind of people that make fast friendships and lasting friendships, and I think by the time we're done today, you're going to understand why. Let's start with Chuck's explanation of how a Southern California 16-year-old ended up in the Navy Reserve in 1937.
I went out to the Long Beach Airport. One of the fellows there in my class said that he had a lot of fun going out there to the airport at the Navy base there in Long Beach. And he said they fly out and they just have a lot of fun. So I thought, well, I'll join the Navy Air Force. So I went out there and signed up in Long Beach. And we used to go out and, well, we packed parachutes. And then we did some dive bombing, and we used to shoot at those sleeves, and it was a lot of fun.
What kind of dive bombers were those?
We'd go up in these little Grumman SF-1s and SF-2s, and they're the dive bombers with the wheels pulled up alongside of it. Anyway, we'd go out. Well, we'd chase the cows over the eucalyptus trees and go down to Palm Springs and get coffee and, you know, I mean, and bomb. And those old planes, we'd go up to bomb, and it'd go right up just like this, you know, and then it just about stall out, and then this is when your guts drop down like that. Come straight down to put their bomb out, you know. I mean, of course, there's nothing like it is now, you know. This is 1938-37. Mm-hmm. And release the bomb, and then when they'd pull out, you couldn't even lift your foot off of the, the plane. I don't know how many G's we were pulling, but it was gee whiz, there was a lot of them. But anyway, that's where I started, and I enjoyed it. We'd go out and shoot at sleeves. They'd tow targets, you know, behind the planes. We put black on some and green and red, and you know, so we could tell who was hitting whatever.
Yeah.
And then we'd come back in and we'd count the holes in the sleeve. Well, anyway, that's where it started, and that was fun. You know, like a kid, that was really neat. My dad was in the Merchant Marine. He was a captain on one of the tankers for Union Oil Company of California at that time. I wanted to go get a job, so anyway, he said, well, you can go out there on one of the tankers there as a mess boy or able seaman or something. You know, I was just old enough to get out there. What was I, Dorothy, 16 or 17, I guess, 17. So anyway, I did that. I went out for one summer. I went out to get on the tankers, so off I went, and we got up to Port San Luis. At the time, the crew on the Santa Maria was in there, but they were so drunk they couldn't get the ship. They loaded it there in Port San Luis. So what they did then was transfer all the crew off of the La Placentia onto the Santa Maria. And I was supposed to be going up and down the coast, you know, my first leaving home. Boy, I get lonely. So anyway, off we went to Panama through the locks down there and unloaded the coal docks and Panama City and everything. And then I've been to Antofagasta, Chile, and all that, you know, on the tankers. Well, anyway, we got back, and that was my first trip on that. But anyway, that's where I started to get on tankers. So that was more or less what I figured I would do, is be in the Merchant Marine. Well, to skip all of the other stuff, I had had an automobile accident. Some guys were drunk, ran a stop sign, hit the side of the car, and wrecked my collarbone, shoulder. So anyway, I had to let that ship go. To make a long story short, the Navy called me in. They wanted me, you know, the reserves. They were calling in reserves. You know, England was in a dire straits at that time,
right. And
they were about ready to go under. Well, I didn't go to boot camp or anything. They just took me down and put me down at North Island, and we flew down there. I had nothing to do with flying airplanes except just riding. But anyway, that's another little story. They had a bunch of dignitaries from South America and everything went on the bleachers. And they had the parachute jumps for to show them what they were doing. So they flew over the field of the parachutes. So the guys all jumped out, but one of them got his leg hooked up in the back of it and was dragging. He flew across there, and there he's dangling up there on the bottom of that plane. And they didn't know what they were going to do with him. Anyway, to make a long story short, this Lieutenant Lowry and a chief, he jumped in a plane, unauthorized, and went up and flew out over the ocean where it was quiet. And what they did was they went up there and they flew up underneath him. Now, we've watched this stuff going, you know. I mean, this is excitement like in a circus. Man, howdy. And so anyway, he took that plane, and the guy got that sucker up in the cockpit, and one guy held up, and the pilot took that plane and that propeller and cut that strap off underneath that plane. Well, that was something to remember. And nobody could remember that except I talked to one of the guys that was at the naval base the same time I was, and he remembered that incident.
Wow.
But anyway, we got him down. He had his leg all wrecked, you know, and he was in the hospital. But he lived, and that was all. But that was one of the things that would go on to impress you. But anyway, I decided I want to go to sea. That's what I was doing, you know, was going in the Merchant Marine anyway. And so anyway, why, to make a long story short there too, why, I went up and saw the admiral there of the base, and he told me there's a ship out there, and he said, yeah, well, okay. So anyway, they put me out on they said, you go on the Perry. Well, I didn't know the Perry from anything else. I looked at the carrier, and I thought, man, that's a neat ship. I want to get on that one. Got on this sucker, and I walked across four decks of those ships before I even knew I'd passed one. I said, where's the Perry? That's the first one. They're only 32 foot wide, you know. So I went back over, and that was my first chance on a Perry. Well, that's when I went up, and I said, I wanted to get married. We were going to get married in September 17th, because then I would have been 21.
That was the plan, but since he was about to ship out, there was just a small window of time in which they could possibly get married, and this is where we need a little of Dorothy's perspective.
I had my first date with Chuck when I was 13, and now my grandchildren say, Mother, did your mother let you date at 13?
What's the answer?
Well, I did it.
Whether she let you or not.
I'm not sure she always knew, but anyway, yes, we've known each other a long time.
So I went up to get permission to leave to go to get married. Well, everybody says there's no chance. Oh, Iron Mike, he's not going to give anybody any liberty or leave. So I said, well, I'm going up anyway. So I went up there, and he said, okay. He said, I'll give you 3 days, but he said, if you're not back here, you're over the hill. So I said, okay. So off I went.
They gave him 3 days, and we didn't have time to get our blood tests and get a license in California. So he borrowed a friend's car, drove the 100 miles from San Diego up to Long Beach, picked me up, and we headed for Las Vegas. We got there at midnight, stopped at a gas station, and asked the fellow where we got a license, and he called the county clerk for us. She came down this big marble steps and all, and she went ahead of us turning on the lights, made out our license for us, asked us if we wanted to be married by a minister or what, and we said we'd prefer a minister. So she said Reverend Melton is always very nice about getting up at night. So she called him, gave us his address. We went out, rang the doorbell. He came to the door, and he said, well, where are your witnesses? Well, duh. I mean, we didn't think of witnesses. So he said, well, his wife would get up. And literally he said this. The woman next door was always very nice about getting up for a couple of dollars. So that's what we gave her. But they both had on their robes, and his wife had a cold, and she stood and sniffed. And for some awful reason, I got the giggles. So Chuck said that I giggled all the way our wedding ceremony. That's what he always says. But we've often thought we should go back and tell Reverend Melton that actually the marriage did stick, because I'm sure he was questioning it that night. We got married, headed back over the back road through Yosemite, had problems with Chuck's friend's car, got back to Long Beach. He again literally dumped me out with my things in my mother's backyard, drove across town, put on his Navy uniform, beat the 100 miles back to San Diego.
Yeah, I got back to the Perry, and the guy said, I don't think he's going to make it. I said, I didn't either. They raised the gang way up there, and I was aboard, and we took the Perry, and we went off, and we escorted the Nevada and the Arizona and the Oklahoma out from Long Beach. See, it was a battleship port. And off we went to Pearl, and well, to Honolulu. And anyway, we went over there, and then my enlistment was up December 3rd of 41, and the ship was leaving for the States December 8th, and my enlistment would have been up. Yeah, I was going to the Oklahoma. My buddy was on the Oklahoma. And I had been over to the sub base and got Dorothy a red sweater and a malt mixer, a mixer. And I was up there, and I was going to go. This was Liberty, last shot, going home, you know, the next day, and everything was all fine. And man, I couldn't believe it. And anyway, that's when the Japs hit. I just had eaten breakfast and came up topside, looked out over there, and then saw these planes getting hit there on Ford Island. That's when I said, hey, here's the Japs are here. And Elmer Tune was real popular at that time. I think they were playing. And next thing I knew, boy, we were at war.
And that young man who had just gone out to buy gifts for the bride he thought he was about to be reunited with, the guy whose enlistment was technically over 4 days earlier, who was a day away from sailing home on the USS Oklahoma, he would see that battleship upside down in the harbor, not to mention the rest of that chaotic scene. He would end up in the Navy for the duration of World War II, and then spend the rest of his 97 years making sure no one ever forgot Pearl Harbor or the importance of keeping America alert. I'll never forget Chuck Lishman, and I hope by the time we're done today, you won't either. It's time for our first break, but when we come back, more memories of December 7th, 1941, aboard the destroyer USS Perry, a ship that would not make it through the end of the war. We'll hear how Chuck avoided that sinking and the other close calls that convinced him God was watching over him. Hometown Heroes will be right back after this. Do you ever have those moments where you realize you've been settling for less than the best for far too long? Sometimes we just accept the status quo without looking around for better ways to do things. And I've got to tell you, when it comes to your money, I believe I found a better way with EECU. Take a look at myeecu.org and you'll see why. EECU is not a bank. It's a nonprofit credit union that's all about taking care of you, you, the member. That's one of the reasons EECU just keeps growing and growing. Close to 300,000 members now in 10 different California counties. Put $250 in a savings account and you'll start earning dividends. Who else is going to do that for you? And access? So easy. Over 30,000 ATMs. Free mobile banking. And what I really love is how EECU always goes above and beyond to serve the community. In 2013, the leadership and generosity of EECU helped establish Central Valley Honor Flight. More than 1,000 veterans now have gotten to see their memorials in Washington, D.C. for free. And that's just one example of the community involvement EECU takes oh so seriously. Again, the website myeecu.org, or just pick up the phone and become a member today. 1-800-538-3328. That's 800-538-3328.
This is Hometown Heroes, celebrating everyday Americans who answer the call of duty.
Yesterday, December 7th, 1941, a date which will live in infamy. The United States of America was suddenly and deliberately attacked by naval and air forces of the Empire of Japan. The United States was at peace with that nation, and at the solicitation of Japan, was still in conversation with its government and its emperor, looking toward the maintenance of peace in the Pacific. Indeed, 1 hour after Japanese air squadrons had commenced bombing in the American island of Oahu, the Japanese ambassador to the United States and his colleague delivered to our Secretary of State a formal reply to a recent American message. And while this reply stated that it seemed useless to continue the existing diplomatic negotiations, it contained no threat or hint of war or of armed attack. It will be recorded that the distance of Hawaii from Japan makes it obvious that the attack was deliberately planned many days or even weeks ago. During the intervening time, the Japanese government has deliberately sought to deceive the United States by false statements and expressions of hope for continued peace. The attack yesterday on the Hawaiian Islands has caused severe damage to American naval and military forces. I regret to tell you that very many American lives have been lost. In addition, American ships have been reported torpedoed on the high seas between San Francisco and Honolulu. Yesterday, the Japanese government also launched an attack against Malaya. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Hong Kong. Last night, Japanese forces attacked Guam. Last night, Japanese forces attacked the Philippine Islands. Last night, the Japanese attacked Wake Island. And this morning, the Japanese attacked Midway Island. Japan has therefore undertaken a surprise offensive extending throughout the Pacific area. The facts of yesterday and today speak for themselves.
President Franklin Delano Roosevelt on December 8, 1941, addressing the nation with regard to the devastation experienced on Oahu the day before. Today, we are remembering Pearl Harbor survivor Chuck Lishman, who dedicated the rest of his life to keeping that history alive and just left us at the age of 97. Chuck was supposed to be headed home to California on December 8, 1941, but the ship that was supposed to take him there, the USS Oklahoma, was upside down in the harbor by that time, with many sailors clinging to life inside its capsized hull. The reunion with his bride Dorothy would have to wait, as the Navy would need his services for the rest of World War II. Here's how Chuck experienced that fateful Sunday morning.
Well, I just got through eating. We slept after quarters in the after part of the ship, and I just had come up topside and was standing there, and one of the fellows from the fire room, he came up, and we were both standing there talking, and we looked up and out over Ford Island, and here come some planes, and we thought, man, look at those planes. They're really doing the same maneuvers. And I says, no. He says, they're just crazy. We saw them drop something, and usually they drop sacks of flour or something, you know. And the next thing I knew, I looked over there, and over on Ford Island, the planes were getting blown up, and everything was going up. They were bombing everything, of course, to keep the planes from taking off, but we didn't know that. But then when I couldn't believe it, I said, this must be maneuvers, the craziest maneuvers I've ever seen in my life. And he says, no. He said, look. And boy, one of those Jap planes flew over the top of us and saw that big red ball, and I yelled down in the after deck house there and said, hey, no liberty today, the Japs are here. And that's when the war started. It was such a surprise. Everybody was standing around looking at it. It looked like it was just maneuvers until everything started going haywire. And then, of course, everybody started running for guns or something. So all we had was 4-inch guns, broadside, and some 30s and 50s. Well, everybody was breaking the locks on the ready lockers and everything and getting shells out of the hole. And that's the magazine. And that's where we started, right there. And, well, first, when we got the guns going, of course, we were shooting down. We got credit, I think, for one plane and a hole through one of the submarines that was in the harbor right off of our stern. There was 4 ships in the pack here with the Perry, and we were all shooting. And I think they had 4 or 5 planes they got down, but I think we got credit for one of them.
The audio you're hearing today is from TV and radio interviews we did with Chuck in 2007. I heard him relate the same memories consistently for years at different appearances around Central California, and I often asked him what he was doing personally during those frantic moments.
I was hauling shells. We were hauling 4-inch shells. We had broadside. You know, we didn't have any anti-aircraft except some 30 caliber machine guns and some 50s. If I'd have had a rifle when those suckers were flying over the top of us, I got to hit one right between the eyes. But anyway, yeah, I was picking up those 4-inch shells. They were dragging them out of the ready locker, bringing them up topside, and I was running back there. And you know, those 4-inch shells are so dang heavy, you could just about get one to load it in the gun. And I had one under each arm, and a Jap plane came down and strafed us, and I dove behind the stack at that time, and the bullets were ricocheting off, and besides Cole, he got hit in the jaw and the ricochet, and they took him into the hospital. But when I looked down there and I had these 2 4-inch shells, I didn't know. I thought, wow, what am I doing with these suckers, you know?
You made yourself a bomb, basically, huh?
So anyway, I got rid of those things to go back there to number 4 gun. I don't know what they were doing with that number 4 gun. I don't know if they were shooting them over in Honolulu or where they were shooting with them, but anyway, trying to get airplanes with a 4-inch broadside gun, what a joke. But anyway, everybody was confused. We had no officers. Well, we had one officer. He come running over the, running up out of the officer's quarters, that's below deck, coming up tight, don't shoot, they'll shoot back. And some electrician mate hauled off and knocked him down the gangway, and he went down below. And of course, here's the thing, he couldn't say anything about anybody hitting him because he was too yellow to take the chip out, you know. So anyway, that just sort of drifted by everybody. So the crew was taking the ship out. We went around to Nevada. Nevada was crosswise in the channel.
Right.
And as we went around to Nevada, they were all yelling, get him, you know, and all that stuff, you know, what was little old... Oh, World War I 4-piper destroyer, you know. Anyway, we went around to him, but then going on out, why, this Lieutenant Ball, he was our engineering officer, he had commandeered a shorecraft, and he caught up with the ship, and then he took the ship. And then, of course, we went out to fight the Japs. And then when we got back in, came out, we didn't find any Japanese. We weren't going to do anything anyway. Came back in, and that's when it really hit me. I mean, if anybody ever wanted to cry, that was it. The battleships were burning, the oil was there, and the guys were floating around in that oil, and the stuff was on fire, and you can't believe it, boy. And then they had this old boat in there running around scooping up bodies. It had to look like a front loader on the front of that sucker, and they called up there Juicy Lucy. They had a big old sign across there, and they were scooping up bodies and stuff through the oil. Anyway, I'll never forget that. It's pretty bad. So anyway, that's the way it went.
For the next 6 months, the Perry patrolled the waters around Hawaii, keeping a lookout for mines near the harbor entrance at Pearl, and also escorting bigger ships like those aircraft carriers that had all been out to sea during the attack. On one such journey, he and the Perry survived an extremely close call. It's a story he had a hard time getting people to believe until he moved to Central California and joined the local Pearl Harbor Survivors chapter, where he finally found someone else who could corroborate his experience.
We escorted the Saratoga into Pearl. The Saratoga was going full bore. She was making about 32 knots. We were supposed to screen her. We were called cover wagon. So anyway, the Japanese, one of the subs, shot a torpedo at her, and it was coming right for the Saratoga. So covered wagon, we were supposed to take the torpedo, you know, to blow us up rather than hit the big carrier. So we went steaming out there, and the captain said, all unnecessary personnel topside. Well, I was very unnecessary. I didn't really see anything down there that I needed to be below deck, so got up on the deck and sitting there watching that wake coming right for us, and closed my eyes, and I figured, well, Charlie, this is it. And nothing happened. I woke, opened my eyes, and here the wake went out underneath us. It was set too low. Oh, darn, I thought that was too bad. So I went over there, and it hit the Saratoga, knocked out three fire rooms, and slowed her down 7/10 of a knot. They have 16 fire rooms on those suckers. It's all gears and everything, you know, in those days. It wasn't like it is now, but anyway, it did knock out. But I told Dorothy that story and some other guys, and they all, you know, a little skeptical about it. You know, it's hard to believe, you know, that it happened. And darn old Joe Ruggles, he remembered it. He was on the Saratoga, and he backed me up, and he says, by golly, I was there, I know. And he went in there, and so there it was, and so that was proof of that. But some of the stories we tell, people can't believe it. We wound up there with that Pearl Harbor bit, and then we came back and went into Mare Island. They shipped us back because they needed minesweepers. So they converted us to a high-speed minesweep, and that's what it was. We could we had 30 knots. You don't sweep at 30 knots, but you get someplace before.
So at Mare Island in California, the Perry gets a makeover. Its purpose for the rest of the war is going to be very different from what it was before Pearl Harbor.
They converted the Perry from 340 destroyer to a minesweeper, DMS-17. We didn't have any new ones. They were all old iron four-pipe destroyers. And that's all they had when the Navy first got them. And they degaussed us, which is demagnetizing the ship, because they were all iron and they attract mines.
So that sounds like a very important step. And minesweepers like the Perry served a very dangerous and important purpose in all the Pacific victories to come.
Every invasion in the Pacific at the time had to be swept before any invasion. Well, that's what we did. So anyway, we went into up into Aleutians for 13 months in the Bering Sea, because, you know, the Japanese were at Kiskanatu and Amchitka. So we went in there. Well, then on Christmas, we were in Kodiak, and we froze up in dry dock, and the Wasmuth took our place to escort the ship up through Udomic Pass going into the Bering Sea. And we froze up, so they took our place. And going through Udomic Pass, the depth charges came off their rack off of the stern, blew her up. That's what had happened. And then so we were in that Aleutian campaign, and I've been in all of that, all the way Kiskanatu. We made all those landings. We had ice in the bilges, 40 below zero, and we wound up there, you know, and those poor devils on the beach. They were up there in khakis and stuff. It was for the South Pacific or some other place in the desert. They were up there freezing to death up there, you know, with no wet clothes. Oh, man, it was sick. Oh, man. Well, anyway, and we had some aboard ship and gave them coffee and whatnot. Oh, yeah, the Crown City ran aground up in the Bering Sea. We were out of food. I mean, you know, the little destroyer, we didn't have all that stuff. You know, we were on rice and beans and hominy grits and stuff, and that's getting old. And the Crown City ran on the ground, which is an army transport or whatever it was, supply ship. So the captain, we were going to anchor. Okay, well, there's no bottom in the Aleutians up there. There's just no way. Anyway, we didn't know all that. But anyway, the captain got up there, and old Hunter was up there on the bow. So we released the hook. Okay, so he dropped the hook, and he says, how many? He says, oh, 5 fathoms. How many? 6 fathoms. How many?
50 bottoms, how many? Endo, let the whole thing go, all the chain, the anchor, the whole bit all went down. We never did see that again. So then we went in by the Crown City. So then he said, sent one of the fellows over there, old Johnny Miller. He got the food and he come tearing back there with his ship, you know, and it was loaded down and everything else, and it was full of ice cream. And the captain was really pissed about that, you know, because he wanted food. He said, food, food. He said, what do you do with the ice cream? Well, bring it aboard. We'll eat it anyway. So anyway, sent him back over there to get some food off of the Crown City, which they did. A destroyer is all fighting ship. I mean, there's no part of it. I mean, the battleships have everything. You know, you can get a haircut, you can get food, you get bread, you get thing. We got squat. In fact, we ran out of fuel oil on there one time and had another supply ship, a merchant ship. We went aboard, got alongside of him and took on fuel. We swapped them cigarettes for whiskey, and some of our crew got swapped. But anyway, to make a long story short again, they sent us from there to the South Pacific, which was 40 below to 140 in the fire room. Believe me, and it's no joke. Guys were just purple. I mean, standing under those blowers. Must remember, these old four-pipers, they were all under four strap. You had an air locker. You'd have to get in there, you open up, get in the locker, close the hatch, go down below, open the next one up, because it's all under pressure. It keeps the fire in the boilers. Now they have the double casing boilers and all that, which is nice, but we didn't have that at that time. Everything was by hand. You open the register, you know, and kicked your blower on and had the fire and kept the fire in there. But anyway, we went down there, and then of course, I'll just not do anything, but we started out going back to Kwajalein Atoll and then Aniwetok. You know, that was our first going back for the Japs. I was in the Kwajalein Atoll, been in Guadalcanal. We went in that. In fact, we ran aground. We bent a screw in Guadalcanal off of Lions Point. Then they sent us down to Buna and Pension Haven in New Guinea. From there, out of a bent screw, two landings down there. And then we came back and we went to Nomea, New Caledonia. They flew us out a screw and they put a new screw on. And of course, from there, we just kept going. We were in Saipan and Guam and Rota. But anyway, we were over there with the Japs over there fighting them, and we went over and refueled off of one of the tankers, the Navy tanker. Now, I don't know whether that was the Neosia or whatever it was, but one of the Navy tankers. Miss River, I didn't know what was going on a lot of this stuff, because when you're down below, I was on the deck up in the Aleutians, but then I went down below because I couldn't see anything tying knots when I could go down and learn engineering. So that's what I went down below with, boilers and pumps and turbines and stuff like that, which I'm interested in that. So anyway, we just had refueled off of the tanker and pulled out of there and just barely could see her on the horizon, and a Japanese sub-sunker blew it up. We've been very fortunate on the Perry. It seems like every place we went, we were just ahead of it or just behind it. It's like up there in the Aleutians. We went into Kiska Harbor. They send that, you know, as because we're expendable. I mean, they're going to lose our little ship before they're going to lose a big ship. So they sent us in there, and all those old guns were pointed down at us, and we figured, well, this is it. So we went in there to see what was in there, all the Japs. But some sub had picked the Japanese up off of the Aleutians before we got in there, thank goodness. So that was another blessing. It seemed like that was where the Perry was the whole bit. Now, I was on that ship. I think we had six naval engagements, and I don't know how many landings. I didn't even, close to 11, but anyway, I never kept track of those, but anyway, out there. And I was on that ship for 3.5 years off of all of that. Went to Peleliu, and 3 days the sucker was sunk. And my section was on watch.
I think you can connect the dots there, but we'll listen to how Chuck spelled it out when we come back. It's break time again, but we'll learn more about the fate of the USS Perry from Chuck Lishman and from Dorothy, his wife, for 77 years before Chuck's passing this month at the age of 97. This memorial edition of Hometown Heroes will be right back after this.
Honoring veterans from sea to shining sea. You're listening to Hometown Heroes with Paul Leffler.
Welcome back to Hometown Heroes, honoring the legacy of Chuck Lishman, one of America's last Pearl Harbor survivors who just passed away at the age of 97. His four children, 10 grandchildren, 25 great-grandchildren never would have been born if he hadn't survived a string of close calls, starting with December 7th, 1941. When we left off, you heard him refer to the sinking of his ship, the USS Perry, just 3 days after he had transferred off of it. We'll get to more specifics on that in a moment, but this was 1944, and Chuck was starting to wonder how many more battles his little destroyer-turned-minesweeper could make it through.
Like, we went into Tin Yan. We swept Saipan, but then this was at Tin Yan, and we were sweeping the mines there. Before the invasion, we went in there before we were going there, we were sweeping, and the Japs were shooting at us, and then the second day, the battleships come in to bombard. The first day we swept, and as we get closer to the beach, and then the second day the battleships and the cruisers come in, and they start bombarding the beach. Well, here we are down here sweeping. The Japs are shooting this way. Shells are going right over the top of it, going, and then the battleships had let loose, you know, and they go, going this way. In there, man, I hope those suckers don't miss, you know. But anyway, that was another thing, too. Another thing, too, when we were out there, this Pigtail Betty, I guess is what they call a Japanese bomber. And anyway, he came down here, and here we had all of our ships out there. He flies down between us, you know, and here we are shooting each other, trying to hit that plane, which is a joke. You know, it's funny, you know, I don't suppose we're not supposed to do that in the Navy, but they did. And one admiral was up there in a spotter plane. He was up there. We shot him down. We didn't give the message, the right code or something like that, so we shot him down. So then we went over and picked him up, and he was cussing. Man, he was really pushed at us. I won't go into all that, but he was really laying down a stream of, no identification, but anyway. And then, of course, we did shoot down some Japanese planes.
And the Perry was going to be headed to Peleliu in September of 1944 when an unexpected and life-saving change came Chuck's way.
What had happened is Brand was second class, and I was third class water tender. So he made first class water tender, the first class petty officer, and I got rated to second class petty officer, and the Navy Department wanted to send a second class water tender petty officer back to go to firing school and turbines and pumps and stuff to Philadelphia for new construction. So anyway, they came down to the fire room. I was down in the fire room, and this ensign came aboard, lieutenant. And he happened to be a neighbor of my uncle's there in Long Beach. So he came down to see me on how everything was. It just happened that way. And I told him, I said, you know, this ship is going to go down. I just have a feeling. I've been on it through all of this stuff. But I just have a feeling that this ship is going to go down this trip. And we had quite a talk to see how the family was and, you know, how you do. And next thing I knew, they came running down there in the fire room, and they said, hey, Lishman, get your gear together. You're going back to the States. Well, that was a joke, you know. I thought they were out of their minds. So anyway, that's the way it was. And anyway, I got off of that sucker. But they threw me down in that motor whale boat and hauled me over there. And that was I think that was Aniwetok. After I left that ship, it went up to Peleliu, got sunk. My second was on, and that's what I meant. All the fellas in my second was killed, every one of them. And Brand had taken my place for my section. I got off, he moved into my section, and he got killed. It was my section on there and watched and got killed. They hit a mine, they sweep mines. And that's what we did. It's very dangerous, and it's very, you know, we have acoustic mines that rattle, and they put those on, and then they have electric, magnetic mines, and they have a great big cable out here with great big generators, and we pulsate them when it shoots out, and then that blows up the mines, and then we have two paravanes that go out the side that cut them loose, and then they come up, and then we shoot them. There's three different ways we get them. Well, they're supposed to go in tandem, and evidently the Perry got out from behind this mine when they made a sweep. They missed it, and a mine got them, and that was it. The Perry went down.
Believe it or not, nearly a decade after interviewing Chuck, I was with a veteran in Iowa who got emotional talking about a childhood friend who'd been killed in the war. It turned out that friend was one of the men who went down with the Perry. Chuck Lishman had known him. And of course, Chuck knew the man, Joseph Brand, who would come to embody in Chuck's mind the concept articulated in John 15:13. Greater love has no man than this, that he laid down his life for his friend. Sometimes that sacrifice comes knowingly. In this case, Brand did not know he would be trading his life for Chuck's.
My section was in the fire room at the time, and the thing blew the fire room and killed everybody there, and one of my replacements was Brand, and he took my place, and all the fellas in my section was killed, and that mine. And of course, the Perry went down. And late, in what, 60 some years, I think, later, they found the Perry.
Yeah, some divers found it actually in the year 2000, and now on that wreckage, they have a plaque that honors the eight men who died. And what the first name on that
first
plaque
name,
is
yeah,
Joseph Brand.
Brand. Yeah.
And he was the guy who took your spot on
that's
the Perry.
Right, in my section. After being on there 3.5 years, it goes out and gets sunk after I got off of it. I think there was 12, possibly 13 minesweepers, and every one of them was sunk. We never got it. We got one ship, I think, that came back to the States was all that was left. No, it was bad duty. I tell you, I give all my prayers and thanks to the Lord. He's been with Dorothy and I, and we both love the Lord, so, hey, I can't thank him enough for my life, for my family.
And as for the discovery of the Perry's wreckage more than a half century after it sank, here's Dorothy Lishman with some of how that came about.
It was one of the fellows that was on the Perry, and there'd been divers looking for it, and Larry Tunks down, he's in Huntington Beach, and he was on it, and he remembered a little differently about where the ship went down. So he was talking to some friends, and three of them, he flew down there, and they hired a diver, a local diver. And Larry was telling him just about where he thought it was, and the divers were questioning because they'd looked for it for years, several expeditions, and the fellows went down and found it. And Larry was so excited. Of course, he couldn't dive to find the ship, but when they found it, he jumped in the water with them and was celebrating. And then the divers eventually made this plaque and threw a lay of flowers out and took the plaque down and planted it by the Perry. And actually, they can't go on it because of the bodies of the fellows that were never recovered.
They're all still there. And of course, in the eyes of Chuck Lishman, who could so easily picture himself in their place, they were some of the real heroes of World War II, paralleled by the heroes who've existed in every conflict and exist in our armed forces today.
Well, I think there's a lot of people here that do the jobs out there that are not what you'd call heroes and decorated and everything else, but just think of all the people that's put their lives on those little ships that go out there and do the job, and they do the job that they're told to do and has to do, and that's what gets it done. They just don't fly over it and get a medal. They earn every one of the medals that they ever get. And those poor guys out here in the Veterans Hospital that are really hurting, man, they're the heroes of the forces in the United States.
We've taken a journey through the most intense of Chuck Lishman's 97 years on this earth, but let's not forget the other half of that 77-year marriage. Imagine being in Dorothy's shoes for all those tense and sometimes terrifying years during the war.
Well, we were married 11 months and 11 days before I saw him after our quick wedding in Las Vegas. And at that time, my mother got us a wedding cake, and we had the pastor came out, and we had open house on a Sunday afternoon and cut our wedding cake 11 months and 11 days later. In the 4.5 years, I saw Chuck 4 times. I realize that kids now have a hard go with their husbands and fathers and sons in Vietnam, but go back 2 generations, and we didn't have telephones and we didn't have email. When Chuck and I got married in Las Vegas, we sent a Western Union telegram home to our parents to tell them that we had gotten married, and I had no contact with him. We got these little letters, and they were all censored, and if any of the fellows wrote anything that they thought was any clue to where they might be or what they were doing, they just cut the piece out of the letter, so you would get it with little sections chopped out. Yes, it was a long time, but when Chuck got back in, I was waiting with our son, who was 5 months old, and his dad had never seen him in San Francisco.
I came back on the General Gordon, and we came into San Francisco, and of course, you got out with points. I had so many points. I had a wife and a child, and my enlistment was up, and I didn't have any trouble having enough points to get out. But when we came back into San Francisco, they just told to get off of the base until they could get our papers together. Well, they gave us a physical. I went up to get out, get my discharge, and I had 102 temperature. Well, I didn't know it, but they said, well, you got to go to the hospital or get out. So I looked over there and here Dorothy and my new baby son that I hadn't even seen. I wasn't going to the hospital even with the temperature, and I figured, heck no, so I want out. Well, I got out. That was a mistake.
You were pretty sick, I take it.
Yeah, I had 102 temperature, but nobody knew what it was. And come to find out, I had indolent fever and something else. I don't know.
And for as long as I knew Chuck, I had no idea until visiting him in the hospital in his final days that he suffered from medical complications from that time through the rest of his life. I never heard him complain about it, and I doubt very many did. He would much rather tell you why we all need to remember Pearl Harbor, as he did in these comments from 2007.
Remember, it's for a sneak attack. In other words, I don't think this country, with as much knowledge as they need, they know what's going on. If we're attacked, then I think we really ought to go at it. And I'll tell you another thing. If this Iraq war had started out like it did in World War II, we'd have cleaned this sucker up in 3 days. We had the manpower and the guys to do it, and they wouldn't have been fooling around over here stinging a bunch of guys over there just to get killed to hold a space. That's the way I feel. You know what I mean. I mean, we wouldn't have fooled around with it. I mean, if you're attacked, you're attacked. Look at Iwo Jima and all the rest of those suckers. Man, howdy. Those guys went in there, Guadalcanal, walling around over there. They fought. They had a cause. I mean, that's the way I feel. I think of the poor devils that's left out there in some of these islands and whatnot. I think, it's a shame. All the people that are hurt, crippled, died for the cause that they did. Have you ever been back to that war memorial back in Washington, D.C.? Well, you walk around and you see all of them, Korea and Vietnam and Pearl Harbor and Kiska and Attu and the Aleutians and the New Guinea and Guadalcanal and all that stuff. And see, and I was in almost every one of those suckers. And when I think how much they fought and died for this country, it really hurts me. And December 7th should be a remembrance. This country needs to be wide awake, keep our military strong. And it has to be. If we go down the tubes, we'll never fall from out. We'll fall from within.
And to illustrate the consistency and sincerity of those feelings, here are some similar but slightly different thoughts from another one of our conversations.
Oh, man, we have to be prepared. We were so sucked in on this war. Nobody even had any idea. Well, it said they didn't anyway, and I'll leave that up to there somebody else. But I didn't know it, and I don't think anybody else did there at the fleet there in Pearl Harbor. They were all standing around and breakfast and getting ready for liberty and everything else. And when this was such a surprise, this United States should never let that happen again. Never, never. Go into war. It's bad. It's not good at all. There's too many people dying, too many innocent people get killed for nothing. But let's protect our own shores and be alert.
Remember Pearl Harbor. Keep America alert. That was always the motto of the Pearl Harbor Survivors Association. Chuck Lishman made it a way of life. And one final word from this man who never knew a stranger and was never shy about telling you how he really felt, sometimes whether Dorothy wanted him to or not. They heard this loud and clear a time or two at Raymond Community Church, where the Lishmans made so many friends over the last 18 years. Chuck felt very strongly that God was directing his steps and preserving his life.
Oh, I know he has. Hey, we've been blessed so far beyond everything we can imagine. Man, howdy, we have been blessed.
I shared those final words with his friends and family at Chuck's memorial service last weekend, concluding that all of us were blessed to have known a man like Chuck. Thanks for allowing us to honor his legacy today. If you'd like to find photos of Chuck and Dorothy as newlyweds and as nonagenarians, go to hometownheroesradio.com and find us again next time on this same station at this same time when we're reminded again of what those on Oahu, December 7th, 1941, those like Chuck Lishman, knew oh so well. Our freedom is not free. If you spent much time listening to Hometown Heroes, you've probably heard veterans from all over America talking about the mission of the Honor Flight Network, taking World War II veterans free of charge to see their memorial in Washington, D.C.
I wanted to see it. I've always wanted to see it since they built it. And to see all those guys there that did survive. And then they get emotional. Pretty soon you get emotional, too.
I tell you, that Honor Flight, I just can't believe what a wonderful deal it is.
Everywhere people came up to us, military guys and civilians, and wanted to shake our hands and thank us for all we did. I kept saying there were 16 million of us, you know, and I only did a little piece. But it was just an emotional high.
When it comes to our men and women in uniform, all gave some, and some gave all. A reality underscored as veterans visit the World War II, Korea, and Vietnam memorials and Arlington National Cemetery.
All those white crosses, they're going to your heart. You just know that there's good guys there, but they had to die. For what? So you could live.
And while they are still living, Honor Flight gives the rest of us a chance to express our gratitude. Won't you encourage the World War II veterans in your life to put in applications for this all-expenses-paid journey to their memorial?
It does something for each of us who have been veterans who go back, whether we're a guardian or whether we're honored as a guest on the flight. It completes our life, really. It gives us a sense of fulfillment that we weren't able to have before, I think.
If you live near me in Central California, find Central Valley Honor Flight at cvhonorflight.org. Wherever you're listening, there's a hub in your area, and you can find it on the national website, honorflight.org. Sign up a veteran, volunteer to help, or donate to this important and time-sensitive mission. It's amazing what it means to these members of our greatest generation.
I'm telling you, they make you feel so good and so wonderful. Let me tell you, I can't preach enough about this. You listening?
The manner in which we were treated and greeted and acted toward was just awesome. It made me believe that the people of the United States are just wonderful.
Time is of the essence. Team up with Honor Flight today and help give our veterans one more tour with honor.